The Birth of Globalization, back in 1492.
What Columbus did, in effect, was bring together the continents, recreate Pangaea, and as a result, there's this ecological explosion as species of all sorts from over there came over here, and species of all sorts from over here came over there. It was the biggest event in the history of life since the death of the dinosaurs, and it was the foundation of the modern world.
That's Charles Mann. We talked to him about his piece in May's Orion magazine, The Dawn of the Homogenocene.
So when we say truth emergency, we're saying that the truthfulness of news is not complete, that in many cases there's deliberate misinformation, and that choosing words, whether it's, you know, you say a disputed territory versus what historically is Palestine, creates an idea that somehow there's these two rival parties disputing over what's there.
And that's Peter Phillips of Project Censored. We talked to him about some of the most important stories you've never heard of, and about bias in the news media. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Columbus set foot on the island of Hispaniola, little did he know the global ecological and economic transformation he was setting into motion. Before Columbus, the globe was divided into discrete ecosystems and cultures. After him, the process of homogenization began. Species migrated around the world while cultures were leveled under the imperatives of a globalized economy. One historian called it the Columbian Exchange, and while it brought benefits to some, it brought great suffering and tragedy to others. But one thing is for sure, there's no going back. Charles Mann has an article about this transformation in the current issue of Orion magazine, The Dawn of the Homogenocene. He's writing a forthcoming book called 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. Mann is the author of an acclaimed book about the pre-Columbian Americas, 1491. Charles Mann, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
We're talking to you this time about an article, although I also understand that you are writing another book. We last talked to you about your wonderful book, 1491, and now you're going to be coming out with 1493?
Yeah, well, you know, it's Building My Brand, I guess, is the title. My publisher once joked that I could be writing a book about shoelaces, and they would call it that. So
1493 and shoelaces. So this article, which is appearing in the current issue of Orion magazine, that is in the May issue, is that correct?
Yes.
Is called The Dawn of the Homogenocene, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. This is a fascinating article that starts out talking about Columbus, and I never really quite realized you really put Columbus at the very origin point of globalization.
Yeah, one way to think about it is this, that 200 and some million years ago, there was a single giant continent, which scientists call Pangaea. Geological forces broke it apart, and that's why we have now the different hemispheres and different continents, and they developed completely different suites of plants and animals. And what Columbus did, in effect, was bring together the continents, recreate Pangaea, and as a result, there was this ecological explosion as species of all sorts from over there came over here, and species of all sorts from over here came over there. It was the biggest event in the history of life since the death of the dinosaurs, and it was the foundation, I would argue, and I think an increasing number of scientists and historians believe, of the modern world.
Well, the modern world, you're really starting out here talking about biology. In fact, you know, we, most of us, think of globalization as an economic phenomenon, yet you're really putting the biology almost as the central or the most important long-term event, although you also talk about the economics.
Yeah, I would say if you had to, you know, it's both an ecological and an economic phenomenon, but if you had to say which one is more important, I would argue that it's primarily an ecological phenomenon.
And what is the impact of this homogenization of a species?
Well, it's been enormous and different in different places. You know, for instance, malaria came over to the Americas where it hadn't existed before and had an enormous impact as one of the drivers of slavery. Things like sweet potatoes and maize, corn, came to China and had a huge impact over there, both economic and ecological. I mean, basically, I could go on and on and on. The point is that this ecological exchange underlies much of what we learn about history in school books today.
Malaria is a driver of slavery?
Well, one way to think about it is this. Because of a kind of a quirk of genetics, which we could talk about if you want to, there's two basic types of malaria, and 90-something percent of the people in West Africa are completely genetically immune to one type, and about they're more or less, to put it crudely, half immune to the other type. And so when the Americas began, essentially started importing Europeans, and when malaria came in areas with malaria, those European servants, indentured servants, got sick, and there's a big nudge, a driver of slavery.
So that is one of the reasons you're saying then that Africans were imported by the colonialists to work because they were immune to the malaria that had come here because of globalization.
Yeah, and if you think of it, it wasn't so much that they consciously thought, aha, these Africans are immune, let's bring them over. It's that given a choice, people could bring either Europeans, you know, Scots and Irish, if you're English, or they could bring Africans, and the people who brought Africans prospered, and the people who brought Europeans had their servants die.
You call this mixing, in fact, there's a name to it, the Columbian Exchange. You call it a biological paroxysm. Tell us a little bit about the world that Columbus discovered, if we want to use the term, although I think that the people who were on the place that he did discover would probably contest it. Where did he come first? Who were the people there in the place that he landed?
Well, he landed in the Caribbean. I should say that the term Columbian Exchange isn't my invention. It was the entire concept was come up with a wonderful historian named Alfred Crosby, who wrote a terrific book 30-some years ago. It's still wonderful reading, called The Columbian Exchange. And in part, the article in the book that I'm writing is to try to sum up the sort of explosion of research that came after Crosby, you know, was the first to really note and put together this phenomenon. And what Columbus came into in the Caribbean was a place that's radically different from what there is now. This, you know, something like half or two-thirds of the species in the Caribbean now are imports. So that the landscape from top to bottom was completely different. There are no real native grasses, for instance. And if you go to the Dominican Republic, which is or Hispaniola, where he landed, there's just large meadows there now. There's completely different suites of shrubbery. There's a lot of shrubs from Ethiopia that made their way there. There's the crops that are grown there are things like bananas, which came from Africa, and also you get a lot of coffee, which also came from Africa, not to mention wheat and cows, which came from Europe. So you saw this radical change in the environment, and this is one of the major reasons, as Crosby noted and argued, that the Europeans were able to do so well. They kind of changed the environment out from under the native people and made it much, much harder to make your living in the way that you had before if you were a native person.
And then added to that, of course, was the terrible toll taken by disease.
Absolutely. By, again, another quirk of evolutionary history, which we could talk about if you wanted, there are relatively few what they call crowd diseases, diseases that are readily spread through the air, really infectious diseases in the Americas at the time of Columbus. So there wasn't any smallpox, there wasn't any flu, there wasn't any measles, there wasn't diphtheria. You can go on and on and on with this list. Now, it wasn't a disease-free paradise. They had, you know, lots of parasites and, you know, other ways to get sick. But nonetheless, they didn't have infectious disease. And so they were what epidemiologists call virgin soil. And Columbus and the subsequent ships inadvertently, I mean, because they didn't have a germ theory of disease, it wasn't that they intended to do this, brought over all these diseases that had evolved in Europe and Asia and Africa. And one way to think about the first sort of 150 years after the Americas were landed on by Europeans is as if the enormous death toll from you know, centuries and millennia in Europe and Asia and Africa from these diseases were compressed into about 150 years. And something between two-thirds and 95% of the people in the Americas died. It was the worst demographic catastrophe in human history, and it had a profound impact both on subsequent human history and on the history of the landscape.
So now, what was this evolutionary quirk that you're talking about?
About 15,000 years ago, there was an extinction spasm in the Americas for reasons we don't really quite understand, and most of the really large mammals died off. And as a result, there were very few domesticable animals. And what that means is that there's only a few animals that are readily domesticated. You can tame, you know, quite a few, but domestication means that you can actually put them in a barn and control their breeding and select for characteristics. And nobody's really been able to do that with, for example, bison. But there were camels here. There were types of other cattle here. There were horses here. There were animals that presumably could have been domesticated, but they got wiped out. And as a result, native cultures, and the cultures throughout the Western Hemisphere, had very few domestic animals. And the reason that this is an answer to your question and not an irrelevant digression is that most of the really bad diseases in human history are animal diseases that had mutation and jumped the species barrier, as they call it, and became human diseases. And we've had a recent example where a kind of bird flu has had a mutation and become infectious in people just, you know, in the last couple of years. And AIDS is thought to be another example. And because there are no domesticated animals here, people weren't around their animals as much in Europe and Asia. They basically lived with them in their barns. And as a result, this kind of mutation didn't have much of a chance over here of becoming a human disease, whereas in Africa and Europe and Asia, there's plenty of people to pick it up. And as a result, they're called zoonotic diseases, built up over there in a way that they didn't over here. And when Columbus came, it was like a pathogenic cavalcade. This huge parade of disease came in one direction much, much more than the other. And I would argue that this is one of the sort of central facts of the last 500 years, was this, as they say, an epidemiological imbalance. There's many more diseases of a certain type over in one place than in the other.
We're talking with Charles Mann about the article that appears in the May issue of Orion magazine that he wrote. It's called The Dawn of the Homogenocene, and it's about how with Columbus came really the first globalization and eventual homogenization of the world's cultures and ecosystems. In fact, then you say, you know, where Columbus arrived, that is on the island of Hispaniola, that when he arrived, there may have been even as many as, 3 to 8 million native peoples there, who we call the Taino now, and that, several decades later, they were down to just 500, and that it might have been a swine flu that wiped out huge portions of them.
Actually, swine flu was probably the first in a parade of diseases, and it's the first real noted plague was in 1493, so that was just a year and a half, actually, after Columbus landed. And then there was a terrible outbreak of smallpox in 1518, and just goes on and on and on. It was about 50 years it'd take for a population that literally has been estimated up to 8 million. That's probably, that most historians think that's too high, but that's certainly a respectable estimate. Several million, I think, is what William Denevan, who's probably the leading expert on this, thinks. And it was down to 500, and today it is generally thought that the Taino were extinguished in about 50 years.
Are we talking about 8 million people on that one island?
Yeah, now, again, 8 million people is probably, that's an extreme estimate, but
but even 3 million.
Yeah, yes, literally on the island. It's a very densely packed place. And the Americas were really thoroughly inhabited. This wasn't some weird anomaly where that was the only densely packed place. Central Mexico, where the where famous for the Aztec Empire, was one of the more densely inhabited places on Earth.
One question that comes up for me when I hear that is, it seems that they must have had a very efficient way of living off the land to have so many people in such a small space. And we must have lost a huge amount of knowledge with the loss of these populations.
Well, if you think of it, we wiped out, or had a serious impact, at least, on entire cultures. And each culture, of course, every culture is a way of being on Earth, is a way of being human. And so when they are destroyed or turned over, the loss is really incalculable. One area, as you mentioned, is agricultural knowledge, and there's a type of land management, it's called polyculture, where you grow many crops at once in a field called a milpa, or just generally means a maize field, and that was sort of pioneered in Mesoamerica and was also done throughout much of North America and the Caribbean. And, you know, when you talk to agronomists, I think quite a few believe that there is much that we could still learn from this today, because there are areas in Mesoamerica that have been continuously cultivated for 4,000 to 7,000 years, and they aren't wrecked. And if you look at places that have been cultivated with the kind of monoculture that we have now, those are very unusual.
This is where they grow corn, and then beans are interplanted with the corn along with squash.
Right. You're growing many crops at once, and it's an extraordinarily productive way of growing things. It's obviously, you know, not what we do at all, and so it's really unclear how well it could be mechanized, for example. But the interesting thing from an ecological viewpoint is that it creates, if you like, mimics a natural ecosystem much more than a field of wheat or rye. One of the things that is the first signs of globalization was that when there was this terrible dying, these people had, you know, managed their landscape intensively. It wasn't a case that people were living lightly on the land. They were managing it in very sophisticated ways. And the countryside, as they say, emptied, you know, or became widowed, to use Francis Jennings's word. And there was a tremendous reforestation. Not only were people no longer clearing land, usually by fire, but there was reforestation. And that the growth of the trees sucked a huge amount of carbon dioxide out of the air and caused an increasing number of climatologists believe, a kind of a worldwide cold snap for several hundred years. It's known as a Little Ice Age. So one of the first impacts of Columbus was this global cold snap that lasted from about 1550 to about 1750, different times in different places.
That's absolutely fascinating. Now you go in your article to Manila, and you talk about two men.
Legazpi.
Yeah, Legazpi and
Urdaneta.
Urdaneta. And you say that these were the ones who really took what Columbus started and really completed the process of globalization, at least in an economic sense, as well as also biological, by kind of making the link between the West and China. Tell us how that happened via the Philippines.
Well, Columbus's idea was that he was going to sail west across the Atlantic and come to China, and that was the goal. And the Western Europeans were completely fascinated by China, which was then, you know, by far the world's richest and most powerful nation. Very much wanted to trade with it. Very much wanted their Asian luxury goods, particularly porcelain and silk. And what they're trying to do essentially was to make an end run around the Islamic states in between that were controlling the trade. Columbus obviously failed. There was this continent in the way. Cortez, who conquered Mexico, actually then afterwards tried to set up an expedition to go to China. This was the great goal of the Spaniards. And in the 1560s, they sent from Mexico these two guys, they're both Basques, Legazpi and Urdaneta, and they went to the Philippines, which they hoped would be kind of like a base from which they could establish contact with China. And in 1571, 440 years ago, just about now, we're almost on the birthday of globalization, they made the connection. And what happened was, for the first time, there is a single worldwide exchange of goods, because before there had been, you know, certainly had been trade with China kind of trickling through, but the Americas were not involved. Half the world was not involved. And here you're trading silver, which they had discovered in South America in what is now Bolivia, for silk and porcelain and sending it to Europe.
And before that, China hadn't really been that interested. I mean, you say China was kind of the preeminent civilization in the world at the time, and they regarded Western Europe as kind of the way we may, you know, subsequent empires regarded Southern Africa, as kind of not a place that was, you know, a place that was too poor to be worthy of trade.
Well, the Europeans didn't make anything they wanted. You know, China's a tremendously sophisticated place. The largest industry in Europe at the time was the textile industry, and what it made was wool. And the Chinese had silk. And so, you know, the Europeans literally did show up with wool and tried to trade it for silk. And obviously, that's going to have to be awfully good wool before the people are going to go for that. And when they discovered this massive silver strike in the Americas, the world's largest, then the Europeans had something that the Chinese wanted, because China used silver for its currency and didn't have any silver mines. And the only nearby supply was Japan, with which it was inconveniently constantly at war. And so suddenly these barbarians show up with massive amounts of silver, and even though they're uncouth and unpleasant and rude, is how the Chinese regarded them, they're coming over with shiploads of money, and they are willing to pay what, from the Chinese point of view, was absurdly high prices for lousy quality silk and second grade porcelain.
Now, what happened to the people of the Philippines themselves? I mean, the native peoples there.
Well, that's actually quite interesting. For a long time, the Spanish took over the place, and for a long time, it's been thought that they're kind of benign. But recently, a historian named Linda Newsom, who's a British historian, has dug through a lot of the colonial records, and it turned out that a kind of a mini version of what happened in the Americas happened there. And between the 1560s and maybe about 1700, something like a third, perhaps even 40% of the population of the Philippines died in the same way and for much the same reasons.
So what is the point now? Now we have a world in which you say we've kind of reconstituted the world of Pangaea when the world was all one continent. Now we're not all one continent, but we might as well be. I mean, we have, at the same time, this homogeneity and also impoverishment, the loss of so many species. Is this something that you think that we can actually come back from? And if so, how would we?
I think to a large extent the die is cast. I mean, it's been 440 years. Take grass, for example. There is no way that lawn grass is going to leave the United States, even though, or the dandelion. Both of those are European species. I can't imagine them being out of the U.S. landscape. However, at the same time, these kind of changes are still occurring, and there's still lots of, destruction to go. You have in San Francisco Bay, for example, I believe two-thirds of the species in San Francisco Bay are non-native. They're brought in by ship ballast. And there's an effort by California right now to essentially tell people to kill their ship ballast. So I would say that, you can't turn the clock back, but you might be able to prevent it from going quite so fast, if that makes any sense, that you might be able to, take profit from the lessons of the past to avoid some of the things that have happened.
Charles Mann, in the minute that we have left to this interview, regrettably, tell us a little bit about the connection between this article and the book that you're coming out with.
This is a kind of a précis of the book. It's kind of like it's essentially an edited version of the first chapter where I kind of introduce the themes. And the book is coming out in August. I suppose I should say you can buy a copy today, at Amazon and all that. And
the title?
Oh, the title is 1493. And you can see what a terrible huckster I am. I would never have survived in the early days of globalization, for sure.
1493. Your previous book was 1492. So if this
1491.
Is 1491. Oh, that's right. 1491, the year before Columbus came. And so tell us, if this is the first chapter, what does 1493 encompass, the whole book?
Well, the first parts of the book, I try to explain sort of the major impacts that happened over the Atlantic and the Pacific, and I focus on, as we mentioned earlier, about malaria and how this really had enormous impacts in the Americas, all the way up to things like the Civil War played a hefty role in the course of the Civil War. And then I talk about the Pacific, where the flow of American crops, particularly sweet potatoes and maize, to China. They were upland crops that could be grown high in the mountains. They led to huge amounts of deforestation. China hadn't grown this kind of crops before. And the 19th century had enormous environmental disasters that played a great role in destabilizing the Qing Empire and the collapse of China. And then I talk finally about the human component of the Columbian Exchange, which was the before Columbus, basically Europeans were in Europe, Africans were in Africa, Chinese were in China, and it all got mixed together, and driving that was the slave trade, which was the, you know, this massive transfer of Africans, which was far more important for a long time than the number of Europeans, you know, sort of 3-to-1 Africans to Europeans.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and we look forward to talking to you about that book. Charles Mann, the article that you've just written in this month's, or from this month's Orion magazine, is The Dawn of the Homogenocene, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
It was very much my pleasure. Thank you.
You can read Charles Mann's article, The Dawn of the Homogenocene, by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Peter Phillips tells us about this year's crop of the most censored news stories.
Mr. Christopher Columbus sailed the sea without a compass. Well, when his men began a rumpus, up spoke Christopher Columbus. There is land somewhere, so until we get there, we will not go wrong if we sing a swing song. Since the world is round, we'll be safe and sound. Till our goal is found, we'll just keep a rhythm bound. Soon the crew was making merry. Yell, let's drink to Isabella. Bring on the rum. A music ended all the rumpus. A wise old Christopher Columbus.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. For 35 years, Project Censored has published its annual report on the world's most important but underreported news stories. Stories like global plans to replace the dollar as the world's reserve currency, or how the U.S. funds and supports the Taliban, or how nanoparticles in everyday products are damaging our DNA. But there are some good news stories, too, ones you likely haven't heard about. You'll hear about them today. Sociology professor Peter Phillips directed Project Censored for many years and continues to work with it. We first spoke with him last year about the organization's 2010 report, Censored 2010. Based at Sonoma State University in California, the project brings academics and students from campuses across the nation and the world together to find, review, and fact-check the stories that the media either didn't cover or covered poorly. I spoke with Peter Phillips back in January, but the stories covered by Censored 2011 are just as relevant now as they were then. We did air an excerpt from this interview a few weeks ago. Now you'll hear the rest. Peter Phillips, welcome to Writer's Voice. Welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Now, we are talking about today about Project Censored 2011. This is 25 years? How many years has
it been? Actually 35 years. The project was started in 1976 by Dr. Carl Jensen at Sonoma State University. Wow. And he did that at Sonoma State for 20 years. Then I was director for 14 years. And we've expanded the project, so now there's some 30 universities involved every year.
And you're really training students to be investigative journalists in some way, right?
Well, I teach a course called Investigative Sociology, which is kind of it's very similar to investigative journalism, where we do reports. We're doing a report right now on immigrant rights. But the critical work for the project is students looking at independent news sources worldwide, finding stories they're interested in, and then validating those stories. So they will research the story and then take it to a faculty member who's, you know, is an expert in that field. And then we call it validated news. And then those are posted year-round on our website at Project Censored. And then those stories are all the nominations for the annual book. So the 30 campuses vote on all the nominations each year in April. And that's how we select the top 25 stories that are the most important.
And you have some real shockers here. The top story is about global plans to replace the dollar. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is something that really most people don't really understand, that the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency for most major transactions in the world, particularly oil. And both China and Russia now have been determining that they're not going to use the dollar anymore for their bilateral trade agreements. China's, in fact, made an agreement with Brazil not to use the dollar. And there's trillions of dollars out there in reserve currencies or in treasury bonds. So that's what the government borrows money, by selling treasury bonds. So the Chinese have $1 trillion, the Saudis have $1 trillion, other countries have hundreds of billions. And if the dollar is no longer the reserve currency, which is the direction that we're moving, those trillions of dollars will become surplus. And when you have surplus money, then its value goes down. And what we'll see is, you know, a deflation occurring. Could happen very rapidly here in the U.S. And to counterbalance that, the Obama administration, and even Bush before that, is trying to push wages down in the country in order to be able to protect the government's treasury bonds.
Wow. So you're saying there's a link between, like, all this anti-union activity?
Exactly. It's a downsizing of spending in the country. That's what they want to do. And they're not going to downsize, you know, the military, which is what's causing the problem. You're spending $1 trillion a year on the military, more than the rest of the world combined. That's what's causing this surplus spending of money and the need to sell treasury bonds. So the Chinese quit buying treasury bonds. So that's why a month ago, or it's actually about 2 months now, the U.S. just, you know, the central bank and the Federal Reserve created, just to, you know, they just went to a computer and says, okay, now we have $600 billion more dollars. And then they bought treasury bonds with it.
That was a quantitative easing, is that right?
Yeah, that's what they have all these funny names.
Now, so let's connect the dots here. We've been hearing about state governments and the federal government pushing back on the power of public sector unions, which are basically the public sector is the only sector where there are still some powerful unions left.
And pensions.
And pensions, that's right. And so you're saying that this is an effort to trim the costs of all non-military spending in anticipation of the devaluation of the dollar that they expect to be happening?
Absolutely. Huh. And it's also to protect profits. You'll notice that, you know, Wall Street is claiming, oh, the best profits ever. It's to protect profit than transnational corporations. These are corporations that operate globally. So their police force is U.S. NATO military industrial media empire. So they're allowed to, you know, do business anywhere in the world with little interference. It's a whole neoliberal model of free flow of capital and control of people.
But there are people who then say, well, China is sitting on the largest store of foreign reserves, most of which is dollars. Wouldn't that hurt China? If the dollar gets devalued?
Yeah, but the Chinese have realized that what they're doing is allowing the U.S. to encircle them and to build weapons, you know, that they could annihilate their entire country. You know, if you go back and you look at the neoconservative plan that was written before Bush the second got in place and talked about containing China and occupying the Middle East and the importance of controlling China's growth, that has a lot to do about oil. China doesn't have oil, so they're buying it from Iran, who are the bad guys, and they're doing oil exploitation around the world, including with Venezuela, but also on the east coast of Africa. And we would like to be able to control that. We would like to be able to kind of shut that down, and the Chinese know it. So we are building a military empire at the expense of our own citizens, to protect transnational corporate capital and to try and control China's growth.
Well, now this relates to number 13 on the stories. We were just talking about number one, about global plans to replace the dollar. Number 13 is Obama cuts domestic spending and increases military corporate welfare.
Is yeah, it? they're very much related. That's Tom Englehart writing. That's Sam Fassini and Dave Zupin. There's a number of stories that come together here. And what's interesting, having 30 different universities, this one was actually, the research was done at St. Cloud University in Minnesota. And they pulled together five stories and then kind of summarized their main points. And that's, yep, we're increasing spending, cut domestic spending, increase military spending. That's the direction. That's where we're going.
And you're listing domestic programs such as education, nutrition, energy, and transportation. I mean, energy and transportation, isn't this the kind of stuff that Obama, you know, campaigned on, saying we need clean, we need to transition to a clean energy economy. We're going to be left in the dust. And aren't there a lot of U.S. corporations actually who are clamoring for support for green energy?
It was a very nice campaign promise. Mm. And it appealed to a lot of people, and a lot of people got a lot of hope. And it's not, it hasn't materialized.
Yeah.
And, you know, the country's wealthier than ever, but the wealth is concentrated. I mean, half of the financial wealth in the country is in the top 1% of the people.
Financial wealth.
Financial mm-hmm. wealth. Mm-hmm. You know, where you have money, you make money off of it. Mm-hmm. Not income, where you have a wage.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next half is spread over the 19% or so in the top. So 80% of us have only 6% of the financial wealth in the country. That's the greatest inequality we've literally that there ever has been. And it's concentrating even more. So like the state of California is $25 billion, you know, deficit. And there's more money in California than ever. There's multi-billionaires here. But it's concentrated in the highest levels. And these powers and these corporate powers have convinced Republicans in particular, but many Democrats as well, who are equally funded by them, that, you know, we don't want any new taxes. So wealth goes untaxed, and the people at the bottom are screaming and forming, you know, having tea parties and coffee parties in protest that they can't make it anymore. Mm-hmm. Wages, you know, a third of the country is working at a Walmart wage, and 10% official unemployment, when in reality 20 have been in decline.
We're talking with Sonoma State University professor Peter Phillips about Project Censored and its 2011 report about the top stories that were underreported or went unreported in the mainstream media.
Yeah, and taxes, you know, I was listening the other day to something on the radio that pointed out that actually taxes on small businesses, as well as, of course, taxes, you know, on Social Security tax and things of that kind, are pretty burdensome. That the Tea Party clamors about taxes and rules and regulations. Taxes are high for the little guy, but they're low for the big guys.
Right. Well, they are. But you're not hearing people, you know, at the bottom who are really having a hard time saying, oh, well, let's tax the rich, or let's go after corporate power. You know, essentially they're either scapegoating, they're blaming immigrants, or they're blaming government being too big, or they're blaming the pension funds from the, you know, state workers and stuff like that. You know, state workers took decades to acquire middle-class incomes. And at the same time, we saw a complete decline and a breaking down of unionization inside the industrial sector, the private sector, let alone the, you know, the deportation of jobs worldwide for lower wages. So, yeah, we have a serious economic crunch happening for, you know, the bottom half of the country and even the next third. And so we're seeing Governor Brown's proposing, you know, a billion-dollar cut in the universities in the state of California.
Right. Governor Brown, does that surprise you?
No. No, he's drunk the Kool-Aid as well. I mean, it's like, okay, we got to quit spending, and we cut back, and then nobody else has any money, and nobody spends anything. And the retail stores are collapsing one after another. You drive through any downtown main street, and half the stores are empty. The economy has, you know, concentrated at the top. You do that, all it does is allow rich people to take their money anywhere in the world where they can get a return on it.
So, Peter Phillips, going on to talk about some more of the stories in Project Censored, some of the other stories we've been talking about, education and universities here. How about number 20? You talk about the charter school movement, Arne Duncan, and again the Obama administration. The book is actually saying that charter schools lead to more segregation?
Yeah, that's quite true. University of California Civil Rights Project has done a couple of major studies on this. The study that we reported on last year was that schools, particularly in the West, the public schools, are more segregated today than they were in the 1950s. So segregation has increased. So you end up schools that are 90% one race, and you know, and 2 miles away there's another school that's 90% a different race. And that's occurring nationwide, but particularly in the West. California is one of the worst. Now, you put on top of that charter schools, where charter schools can pick the people that they want. They can hire their teachers outside of union organizing. And some of these are private profit-making companies, and some of them are just local parents or groups getting together. But it still is the same effect. They get to pick the kids that come there. So charter schools are, in fact, more segregated than the public schools.
So how does this fit into some of the ideas, what we were talking about before, the cutting of public funds to education?
Well, that's exactly what it is. Public spending is being cut. So you privatize it by putting it through profit-making corporations. You pay the teachers less. You don't have unions. You get to pick the kids you want. So you're kind of, you know, hand-picking the kids that are going to do the best. Then you say your scores are better than the public schools. Then the public schools are quote, failing. And I saw there was a piece, I think it was an AP story, even today, saying that college students don't learn very much in college.
Hmm.
And, you know, so that we're kind of undermining this whole idea of a college education for the masses and going back to a model where if you've got the money, you get to go to college. And elites and higher-level income families are going to be able to go and send their kids. And the rest of us are supposed to just sit around and read books or go work somewhere else.
Or go on the Internet and read Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Now,
if we trust it.
Yeah. Now, here we have another one, moving on to some environmental issues. There are a number of stories about that. But this is one that I pay a lot of attention to the environmental news. I haven't seen this before. Nanotech particles pose serious DNA risks to humans and the environment. DNA, that means that these are mutations that can be carried down the generations.
Exactly. Personal products we use every day, our cosmetics, suntan lotions, clothes we wear, contain atom-sized nanotech particles, some of which have been shown to sicken and kill workers in the plants that use them. Now, these are so small that you can't see them. And they pass into our bodies. We have no idea what the long-term consequences of these can be. Nano silver is used in products all over the world, including clothes, garments, everything we see.
Sunscreen. And sunscreen has it as well.
Sunscreen, yes. And this, you know, today's science is unable to predict how this will behave in our bodies. There's no way of checking these thousands of consumer products with these nanoparticles in them and what the long-term applications are. And there's some indications that this could be causing permanent DNA damage in the human species.
And it also, this article says that it could threaten the global food chain. How's that?
All living things can be impacted by these nanoparticles, smaller than a human hair, can only be seen by the most powerful microscopes, are deliberately put in there, a billionth of a meter. So the British study shows, you know, the toxic gossip of what nanoparticles infect, genetic damage to DNA can do. We're just beginning to have some understanding of this.
Now, you have a section in Project Censor 2011, a truth emergency section.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
One of the truth emergencies is around Palestine, and talks about the use of language such as disputed territory as opposed to occupied territory. Talk about the truth emergency around the situation with Israel and the occupied territories.
Well, we started using the terminology truth emergency about 5 years ago because we began to realize, particularly during the Iraq War and the lies that led up to that, that news is managed. It's a top-down managed information service within a controlled environment. So when we say truth emergency, we're saying that the truthfulness of news is not complete, that in many cases there's deliberate misinformation, and that choosing words, whether it's, you know, you say a disputed territory versus what historically is Palestine, creates an idea that somehow there's these two rival parties disputing over what's there. You've got people that live there, and you've got the Israelis building projects in over the entire area of Palestine, settlements, which are, you know, technically legal under the UN agreements, but that doesn't get played out. We don't get the whole story. And whether it's about Israelis, or it's about state crimes against democracy, or it's media arguments relative to going into Iraq and the war, we all know there's no weapons of mass destruction. So we killed deliberately well over 1 million people in Iraq by invading that country. That the national surveys now show that the civilian deaths are in excess of 1 million. And half of those were killed by U.S. forces. You won't see that coverage anywhere in the American press. It's in the foreign press. It's in the London press. But it's not in the United States. They won't use 1 million dead Iraqis. They won't say it.
And the impact in Palestine on children, you know, this morning I heard a searing interview. We're talking today now on January 19th, interview with the Gaza doctor Izzeldin Abulayesh. His three daughters and a niece were killed by Israeli rockets. The chapter in Project Censor 2011 talks about the arrest at 4 o'clock in the morning of a 10-year-old boy. Talk about the psychological scars on the children of Palestine.
If you grow up inside of war, you grow up inside of the insecurity of bombs going off and your parents' lives in danger, or your home's invaded in the middle of the night, or bulldozed in front of you, that's going to have permanent psychological damage, permanent despair. And this is, you know, it's a process of trying to get the Palestinian people to move out of Palestine so that the entire region can become Israel. And it's deliberate, and it's not disclosed in this country. It's presented as a two-sided issue, and, you know, that the terrorists are attacking the Israelis. And the death rates, you know, during the last bombings in Gaza was 100 to 1. 100 Palestinians died for each Israeli. During the entire Enfantada, it's been 20 to 1. And so, sure, the impacts on these kids, they're surviving, often in rubble, or just without medical care, efficient, everything. It's just, it's a terrible, terrible story. And Nora Burrows Friedman, the author of this chapter, has spent major part of her life over there documenting this story. So we're very, that's chapter 8 in the book this year, The Invisible Victims, U.S. Corporate Media Censorship of Israeli International Law Violations in Palestine. And it's a very solid, strong chapter.
Now, you also have some stories of hope and creative change. We need some good news, too, huh?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of people doing a lot of really positive things in the world. In this chapter 4, which is the signs of hope, stories of hope and creative change in 2009 and 10, is put together by Ken Burroughs and his students at the University of San Francisco State University. And they comb through independent media looking for stories of community organizing, success, environmental changes, positive kinds of things that are there. And we find that a very, very uplifting chapter in the book. A lot of it's pretty depressing.
I noticed that you took a lot of them from Yes Magazine, which is, tell us about Yes Magazine. And
well, they're a very, we love Yes Magazine, and they're a strong monthly that reports on positive things that people are doing, which often don't make the news. The news is often doom and gloom. Positive things that people are doing worldwide, and I see it all the time, and I really like it.
And some of those stories relate to the state where we produce the show. I didn't know that there was a bill in the Massachusetts legislature, as well as in 4 other states, to promote the development of state banks.
Very much so. I mean, that would be the idea of having banks North Dakota is the only place that does it. And they're one of the few states that are solvent right now. So if you have, you keep the money in the state that you've got, and you're not allowing transnational corporations to remove it. If you think about this, if they put a Walmart in your town, Walmart's not coming there to leave capital. They're coming there to take capital out. So the overall amount, overall result is the capital's removed from your region. Now, if you create the same kinds of services that Walmart has and have the state help them and you have a central bank in the state, then you can retain that capital. It circulates more within the people there and everybody's better off. It's pretty simple. It's a pretty straightforward idea. Corporations treat local areas like they're colonies. And, you know, colonies were a place where you went to take things out to make money on, not leave resources and money there.
Right. Now, I want to ask you a question. Journalism is under a lot of pressure these days, especially investigative journalism, because it's expensive, it takes a long time. Is the Internet helping or hurting media democracy?
It's helping. I mean, all these stories that we find are on the Internet. There's still a lot of print publications. We get probably 100 different publications, but everything's on the Internet now. What's dangerous is it's just anything that's not true can be on the Internet as well. So sorting out what's valid and what's not is often beyond the capabilities of a single person. So the vision of Project Censored and the direction that we're going with universities all over the world now validating independent news stories is that when we post these stories on our site, they have been through a university review, meaning that these are valid news stories. And then as you start to see their sources, you can begin to understand that, yes, I can trust Yes Magazine, or yes, I can trust Salon or Raw Magazine or Huffington Post or whichever site you're using, because they have been looked at and evaluated and validated by university professors and students doing research on the stories.
Well,
and so that's our vision, is hundreds of universities around the world validating independent news stories from Internet sources, because there's lots of journalists out there, a lot of people doing really good things, and there's a lot of governments and national security services that are trying to tell you a different story.
Right. Now, people can go to the Project Censored website and actually read all these stories. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. All our 35 years of stories are up there. You can search within the site for topics. We have a daily blog where we have some 35 writers that are posting material. We have a validated news site where we're posting all the stories from the universities, and then we have a new RSS news feeds from sources that we trust. So we have the Christian Science Monitor, Democracy Now!, Consortium News, and 33 others that we think are valid news sources, and people can go there and see their daily news. There's more there than in the New York Times.
Great. Well, Peter Phillips, we will link to the Project Censored website where people can go and read the top 25 stories of 2011 as well as all those other stories that you have there. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us again this year.
Thank you very much, Francisca.
You can find links to the Censored 2011 stories at writersvoice.net.
We end with Marge Bruchak's story of the bringing of corn to the native peoples of Massachusetts. Bruchak is an Abenaki storyteller and expert on the indigenous tribes of New England.
Corn, or Zea maize, is now known all across the continent. It was originally cultivated, very carefully cultivated, over a long period of time to create larger ears and larger kernels in the Southwest, and then it was traded across to various peoples. And Native people all across the country have different stories of how corn came to them. So, for instance, the Cherokee people in the South describe corn as an old woman who brushes the sides of her body, and as she brushes her body, the kernels come off. There are places where she's described as a very young woman. And the story that we have in Abenaki territory talks about corn as a young woman who comes in the middle of winter during a starving time. And when she comes to the people, she's very tall and very lean. She has a long green dress that rustles when she walks. And she asks for a place to stay through the winter. And the people take her in, and they give her room in a lodge, and she sleeps with four grandmothers. and she spends the whole winter with the people. And through that winter, she can't speak their language, but she learns a few words. She listens to the story. She watches how the old care for the young and how the young care for the old. And when spring comes, she gathers those people together. And she says to them that she is grateful for the way they have cared for her, even though she is a stranger. She is grateful for the way they have treated her like a sister. And she has a gift to give to them. And she tells them to give them this gift, she will have to die. And the people say, "Oh, no, sister, you don't have to die. We have good medicine people. We can cure you." And she says, "No, no. When I die, you will take my body and you will lay it in your fields. You will pile the earth over it and you will watch that place, and my gift will come to you." And so with heavy hearts, the people do as they have been asked to do, and they take that woman's body and they lay it in the fields, and they pile the earth over it, and they watch and they wait. And when spring comes on, a small green plant grows out of that place, and it is just the color of that woman's green dress. And it keeps growing. And as that plant gets a little taller, it has leaves that come out and they rustle the way that woman's dress used to rustle when she walked. And the plant keeps growing. And when it gets to be as tall as that woman was tall, it grows seed pods on the side. And from each of those seed pods is hanging long strands of sandy brown hair, like that woman's hair. And when they peel open the seed pods, there is the gift. And this is the food she gives to them. And so the people right away, they give thanks, "Bemkikta, kikta, olioni," to the earth and sky for helping that plant to grow. They give thanks to that woman for coming to them. They give thanks to all of the grandmothers for looking after that woman like she was their own kin. And there's a song that goes along with that. It's called the Green Corn Song. And it's usually sung in four parts, thanking the four grandmothers that looked after that woman. And it kind of goes like this. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Olalikikwehawanneo, 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 olalikikwehawanneo. Oh, Lord,
that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests and see videos or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.